Yes, I've been hoping that some sort of benevolent timekeeper would sort of nod and make some sort of sign, but
I think she's doing it.
Yes, well, I've been hoping that we would...
feed in.
Hello, thanks. Alan Leonard, Northern Ireland Foundation. John, I want to pick up with what you said about individual memory, because I think it's quite powerful. If it might work in okay. Everyone hear me all right? From what little I know about how about memory works, I'm intrigued about the old hippocampus and decide and our each of our minds and the job that the hippocampus does in deciding what to remember and what is not important to remember, and how to, an awesome and difficult task that is. So what I'm saying is that each of us right now, all the time, our minds are deciding what to remember, what not to remember. A lot of that's based on what we've learned was worth remembering in the past and what wasn't worth remembering. So it's like you say, it's an ongoing process. Coupled with the fact that each of us in our minds, rational beings, have a propensity to always be right. We always have to be right in our minds. So each and every one of us. So, John, how does this conflate into the collective, you know, about a community deciding what is worth remembering, what's not worth remembering, and for the community always to be right? And another question I have for the whole group is, when does a community decide it wants to recover? Because in the title of today's speech, we're talking about recovery. And again, John, you know, and I spoke previously about how I've dealt with an individual recovery process, and I propose that a community also goes through a recovery process. Might be different. I'd like to learn more. So that's why I asked the question.
Well, let me just pick up while folks are coming up with other comments. When in our minds we're deciding what to remember, it's not just a question of what's worth remembering. But if you ask any dentist, they will tell you the percentage of people who forget their dental appointments. Because actually, it's not a very welcome thing to remember. And so when you're sitting in the dentist surgery next time and being frustrated because there's a bit of a queue, remember that the dentist generally has to book in a lot more people in order to have a full number of people to deal with, because it's not welcome. And it's the same with our communal memory. There are things we don't want to remember because they're uncomfortable and unpleasant and difficult. There are other things that we cannot help but remember because they were unpleasant and difficult. So it's a rather complex issue. Remarkably little of it is to do with rationality and logicality and the truth of what happened, seen from all different perspectives. It's very much what we felt and how we responded to that. Now, you've referred to a particular part of the brain. Obviously, when you're dealing with a whole community of people, you don't have a single brain in the same way. But there are equivalents. They're not identical, but there are equivalents. So in the same kind of way as our personality is made up of all sorts of experiences and expressions, the equivalent for a community would be culture. I mean that in a very broad sense. Yeah. The way a community operates, the way of being in the world of that community is different from the way of being in the world of a different community. And so its reactions are very different. So there are equivalents. But I just want to use that opportunity to say that dealing with individual people's difficult experiences and legacy of the past is a quite different thing from dealing with the experience of a community as a whole. So you can take individual people who have had bad experiences and difficulties and treat them and deal with them. But resolving the problems of a community is not a question of getting 100% of the people or 70% of the people or 40% of the people into individual treatment. That's not the issue. It's a different thing at the level of the community. And it's one we know less about. It's more complex and we know less about that. One thing is clear. Both at the individual level and at the community level, if the problem that led to the difficult experience is continuing, it's very difficult to resolve it. So if you got an infection because you were living in a place with a lot of infection, you need to take the person out of the infection, out of the infected area, before you have any chance of them recovering. But simply taking them out of that won't necessarily enable them to recover. Sometimes there are more things that need to be done. So if you're in a community which is actually under attack, there's no point in saying to people, let bygones be bygones. But even if you deal with the attack, the bygones won't necessarily become bygones without a lot of work done.
Yeah, and picking up culture again, as you mentioned again, I don't think one can, I absolutely agree, you can't make a community recover. I think it's, you can't force a person to recover, you can help them to recover. Communities are made up of individuals. But what you can do is you can monitor the progress of the community recovery. And how do you do that? One of the ways you do that is through culture. When you take Somalian children into school, and they won't, Somalian refugees, and they won't talk about their experiences, of course they won't talk about their experiences, but you set them a task to draw a picture about anything that comes into their mind, there won't be a single child on the roof who will draw anything but horrors and unspeakable horrors. And 10 years on, hopefully, you will start to identify that some of them have started drawing pictures about mummy and daddy at home and started healthy pictures that show that they are moving on. And the members of the community who are not yet able to do that and are still drawing pictures about the horrors, they can be approached separately and taken out of the community context and given the sort of individual help that you're talking about. But I don't think there is a way of community counselling or community therapy. Tell me if you think I'm wrong, but I don't think you can do that.
I don't think you can do community therapy, but I don't think necessarily it's impossible to deal with a community as a whole and help it to face some of these kinds of issues.
And that is, in a way,
the challenge for us as to how we find a way of doing that. But there's no point in putting up your brass plate and saying, community, come to me for treatment. That's craziness. But
thank you very much. A couple of quick responses to fascinating thoughts. Too many of them to process all at once. But just one, you raised the point about lest we forget, you know, can we point to any example of say people saying remember the Holocaust and therefore not having another genocide? I think you're right. I can't think of an example. The other way round maybe works, that the failure to remember does lead to Holocaust, rather than that remembering leads to non-Holocaust. And the prime example in the day that we're in it is Hitler's famous statement, you know, who now remembers the massacre of the Armenians as his justification for the final solution. So I think it works the other way around. Second point to John, you seem to make this sort of binary between history and memory, or what historians do and what the rest of us do. I think historians are just professional memory people, and like all memory, it goes through fashions.
Accuracy,
but I don't think there is such a thing as objectivity even from historians. I think what you get is fashions, and it's almost a cliche that says that if you look at what historians say at any point, it almost says more about that point in history than the point of history at which they are writing about. So there are fashions and everything else in professional memory, just as they are in collective memory, and indeed in individual memory. And the last thing just to point out is drawing this point about the Somali kids, the notion of transgenerational trauma. We're coming up to, I mean, it's not just the anniversary of the Holocaust, the anniversary of the end of the Bosnian debacle, but it's also coming up to a few days from the 43rd anniversary of Bloody Sunday. And on the 25th anniversary, I think it was, at the memorial in Derry, two young people got up and they read a poem, a very powerful poem, where they said, you know, I remember the smells, I remember the shouts, I remember seeing so-and-so being shot dead. And the last line of the poem is a staggering line that says, and I wasn't even born. Now, to me, that poem just completely knocked me off my feet. And what I'm supposed to ask is that trauma? Is that failure to process? Is that false memory? Or is that actually a very healthy thing that this young generation of people who weren't even born that day say, I'm not going to forget that, even though I wasn't there?
Or is it trauma or is it manipulation? That's the danger. Is that the fact that you've got people who weren't somewhere and have powerful memories, those memories must have been implanted by somebody. Were they implanted by somebody who has an agenda that group is being used to perpetuate? And that's what worries me.
Well,
what's in relation to that particular example?
There's a very interesting phenomenon about particular memories, either individual or group, that come to have a symbolic significance.
Yes.
Bloody Sunday was one, the Sharpeville Massacre was another, and so on. And actually, if you look at the exact detail of what really happened, it's less important than what it has come to mean. And it often pulls together a series of memories. We find this in working with individual people. They remember something absolutely definite, but actually it's a pulling together of various memories that have a symbolically powerful meaning that express something very important. And as I say, Sharpeville was one, Bloody Sunday was one. There are a number of these. Mm-hmm. And they should be attended to, not to do with their accuracy or otherwise, but because of the meaning that they express, they encapsulate, they crystallize something.
Yeah. I think we had a...
Thank you very much. I wondered if you could say something about the role of the other in all of this. So I was thinking about that when you were talking about Angela Merkel's visit to Parliament and how that kind of confronted us in a way that we might not have anticipated, or indeed of the Armenian genocide. And if Turkey was suddenly to acknowledge the genocide, there would be this kind of hooray moment, I imagine, amongst Armenians, but it would take a very long time to move to a place to where that became memory. So how does the other help us or interrupt us, if you like, in moving event and experience into memory? And if we don't deal with the other and live through this with the other, whoever that might be, then do we not run the risk of running into them in the future and memory erupting into present again?
Great question. I'm not sure, you know, if I have a prepackaged answer to that. I mean, try to concretize it a bit. In relation to the Armenian genocide, the Armenian and Turkish government are in conversation about that, and there is a structure which leads one to believe that there may be greater understanding. And interestingly, one of the aspects of this is an historical commission to look again at what actually happened and its larger world context in the setting of the Great War. So where there is that contestation about memory, then the protagonists, it seems to me, have to engage with what happened. That's why, I mean, it's you know, maybe this is a kind of a professional deformation. When I hear about Sharpeville and Bloody Sunday and there are comforting myths around that, I want to find out what happened. I want to sort of, that if it's, there were sort of 30 people killed here, that's not true, it was 10, and here's how their deaths occurred. I'm curious. And maybe that's a bloodless study, that's a level of sort of a selfish intellectual curiosity. I think it is. I think it's about truth. And I think that myths can be comforting, as we've seen, they can be hugely armor-plated. But I think myths, when founded on untruth, have got to be confronted.
Well, there's one thing I'd say about this, though. To me, the issue in terms of Bloody Sunday was not the exact detail of it all. And that was the mistake, in a way, of the investigation. The key thing was the heartfelt apology of the British Prime Minister for what had happened without let or hindrance, and that had an impact on people. It doesn't answer all the questions, but it had an impact. Now, on the question of the Turkish-Armenian thing, One of the problems is, if Erdogan were to come out tomorrow and simply apologise, he'd do two things. He'd antagonise most of his own people,
yeah.
And secondly, on the Armenians would say he doesn't really mean it. So there's a whole process that you've got to go through. Why? Because the business of being hurt becomes part of the identity of your community. It's not just a memory. It is part of my identity that I am part of a community that suffers these kinds of things over and over again. And the process of allowing that to change and to become a community that has had things happen in the past, but they do not need to happen in the future, and it's not an essential component of me, is the process the whole community has to go through, Dan.
I mean, it's exactly that. And it's Nelson Mandela's difference between compensation and reconciliation, where compensation is something that is done by the aggressor to the victim and in some ways can perpetuate the inequality in the situation, whereas reconciliation is something where the other, as you call it, where both sides have to do it together. And it is a process of, and it means that instead of memory becoming a frozen thing that is becoming increasingly obsessive by one for one group of people and resented by another group of people who weren't there, so it's not real for them, it becomes part of the growth and development of the relationship between the other, between the two others, between the two parties. So I think it's exactly that. And it sounds as though what you're saying is, in political terms, that may be reality, but in psychological terms, psychiatric terms, that makes sense as well.
Stephen White, first of all, thank you for a very interesting conversation that we've been able to listen into. And not surprisingly, coming from a legislative and lawmaking background, you started off with the importance of legislation. I come from a law enforcement background, but also change management and leadership. So all the things you've talked about, legislation, policies and procedures, there's also the human side. So I'd be interested to hear a little bit about how you perceive the role of leadership. Because whilst there's a comment you made which really struck me about it's difficult to give a community therapy, but you can give individuals therapy. And the importance of individuals, whether they be religious leaders, political leaders, community leaders, to me that's the key to successful recovery of countering a narrative of extremism or immovable hurt. So maybe just a comment on leadership would be useful, I think.
Well, let me, respond to the question by identifying a problem rather than offering a solution. And it's something I think that the more effective leadership in a divided society such as this appears to be, the risk is that the more out of touch it can either appear to be or in fact be from the divided communities who are not themselves united. So, you know, we're all familiar, of course, in this part of the world with the Chuckle Brothers. But it was the very success or apparent success of that relationship that led to part of the problem with the senior partner in that relationship in his host party in his wider community. And I think that's the difficulty. And back to John's reference to Turkey. It's absolutely right. You know, if Erdogan went as far as the Armenians might wish him to, he'd lose the capacity to effectively lead that country.
I totally agree with that. If I watch Aung San Suu Kyi shaking hands with one of the generals who imprisoned her as many years ago, it depends who I am. If I'm a youngster in Myanmar, I look at that and I say, excellent, the leaders are giving the sign, bygones, we're moving ahead, and I identify with a new generation where the memory has ceased to become an obsession. If I'm somebody sitting at home, and my wounds from the camp have still not, yet I'm still getting up every day in pain because I'm still suffering, and I see the same leaders embracing, what that does is it expands the gulf between politics and reality for me as a person. And it's getting that balance right that I think is the challenge of leadership.
The Chuckle Brothers' biggest mistake was looking as though they were enjoying each other's company. This was Nick Clegg's big mistake in the Rose Garden. It wasn't just going into coalition with the Conservatives, it was looking as though he enjoyed it. And if you go in and look as though you're hurting, and you may well be hurting, then actually you can represent something. And there have been episodes of leadership in the way that people have described things. Famously, for example, John Hume speaking about a united Ireland and saying, but the island is united, it's the people who are divided, and we've got to get the people to find a way of sharing this piece of land. Or David Trimble saying, just because people have a past doesn't mean they can't have a completely different future, was saying something very important in a way that a lot of unionist people could listen to. One of the great difficulties is, if you have been a leader who was leading a conflict against the establishment, you develop a way of thinking and speaking that is essentially about pulling it down. And a whole way of thinking for your community. Once you move into being inside, it requires a completely different way of thinking about things. And some people can make that transition with difficulty. And some really just find it jolly difficult to make the transition. And they either don't make it at all, or they flip over in a way that makes it not genuine for their own people. So this business of leadership is incredibly important, because you can either move forward and lose your people, or you can find ways of bringing your people forward. But it's an incredibly skillful thing. And somebody who's a good leader at one time may not be a good leader at another time for various reasons.
Mr. Turley and guests, my name is Neville Finch. I've listened with great interest to the analytical discussion. I perhaps am looking at matters in a more basic, taking a more basic approach. I share a common heritage with Mr. Greenberg, a proud heritage. And I take the view that if we don't remember what has occurred in the past, we do not exist. How do we combat tragedy? We remember that tragedy. Tragedy governs the remembrance of tragedy governs how we approach matters in the world today. And I can recall a visit I made to the University of Tel Aviv, to the Museum of the Diaspora. And if I may, Mr. Turley, just quote from my note, remember the past, live the present, look to the future. That is, I think, how we should deal with the issues which have been discussed today. One further comment I would make, and I have to say with respect, it's not a criticism to my good friend who's watching me very, very carefully, but perhaps it's just my old age has overtaken me. I have at times found the audio equipment somewhat hard just to follow. But I think with respect to Lord Alderdice, you refer to the Israel-Palestinian conflict, and I think you asserted that the Israelis were doing to the Palestinians what was done to them. I hope, did I hear you correctly, sir? I think it's not the first time that you've adopted that position. And it's a calumny which certainly I would deny. Thank you.
I discussed this briefly on other occasions. I don't think that Lord Alderdice, if I may say so, take anything like a simplistic position as that. And as I say, I don't think it is helpful to get into the details of Israeli politics today. But what I want to say two things. I think that I would repeat that I think everybody who has been a victim and learns from their victimhoods to influence how they behave when they are in a situation where they could become aggressors is enriched by the memory and is enriched by the experience. And I think what Lord Alderdice has done from his professional background is point out that there are dangers of different treatment of memory that all of us, anywhere in the world, have to be aware of.
Well, that's absolutely right. And not only that, and this is the issue for all of us, not least in this country, the concern is to make sure that we do not find ourselves sliding into something horrible happening again. And what I observe in the Middle East, and sometimes even see in this part of the world, is the danger that people who desperately do not want something to happen again find themselves doing things which actually make that more likely. And that's one of the tragedies of the human condition. It's not rational, but it's powerful. And my concern is to try to find ways in which we in this part of the world and others in other parts of the world move forward to the better future that you're describing in learning from the past, rather than, unbeknown to ourselves, making mistakes in how we handle the past that lead to a not good future rather than the better one we can share.
And I think anybody needs to disagree with that. Full stop.
I think the two points that occurred to me in what Neville said at first speak, I think it's striking that in Israel, perhaps uniquely in the countries of the Middle East, there will be a self-critique which you simply don't find anywhere else. I think it's remarkable. Secondly, and you probably didn't intend this, but you've prompted me to think of the awful phenomenon that we now have here, as if we hadn't got sufficient polarisation of our own. We now see the display of Israeli flags in loyalist areas of Belfast and Palestinian flags in nationalist areas of Belfast. And where does one start? The tendency to caricature, to oversimplify the complexities of the Middle East, when we haven't mastered the nuances and difficulties of our own, I think is.
And it's back to that gentleman's point over there, if I may say so. One of the issues about the ethics of memory is gratuitously borrowing other people's memories that have nothing to do with me and making them an excuse and a justification for all sorts of random conduct. If we were going to take Eva's invitation to produce a law of the ethics of memories, one of them would be you don't use memories, anybody's memories, to justify things you couldn't justify without them.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Do you want to come back on any of that, Neville?
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. It's 10 o'clock and I'm mindful of the fact that you are all very busy people. I'm very grateful to you for spending the time today. Before you roll up your metaphorical as well as your actual umbrellas and take off, can I just draw your attention to some of the other events that are happening throughout this week for Holocaust Memorial Day? And they do engage with other communities who have suffered as a result of the Holocaust in Nazi Germany. We have events down at the Red Barn Gallery looking at those living with disabilities, being performed and presented by those with disabilities, those from lesbian, gay and bisexual backgrounds, and a variety of other specific events related to the Holocaust and the other genocides. I'd like to thank you very much for your time today. I'd like you to join me in thanking our three eminent speakers here and for their contributions and for giving us not only food for thought but the opportunity to work in partnership with our partners at the Centre for Democracy and Peacebuilding and the Institute for Conflict Research, because we're only going to get there in partnership. So thank you for working with us, and let's keep these conversations going publicly and together. Thank you very much, speakers.